Well, before we begin today, let me open with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, our Heavenly Father, You are heavenly. You're the creator of heaven and earth. You're the author of all things, and therefore You have authority over all things. And You are the one who has established the boundaries and borders of nations, determined their places and times. And as we ponder this day, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire in the West, I pray that You'd give us wisdom as to the causes, and I pray, dear Lord, that we would understand a bit of the thread of Rome that continued through London to America, of the good things that were there, by Your grace, Your common grace. I pray that You'd give me a clear mind, help me to explain things clearly. We pray that You would rebuild our ruins this day and restore our race at this time, in this place, in America, for Your glory and our good. In Christ's precious name we pray. Amen. Well, we're in the middle of this topic on Rome's imperial glory and decay. Let me just quickly go through a little review from the last time we met, to get our minds kind of in sync of the flow of history. You remember that we covered just a bit at the end of the Roman Republic. Remember, the legend is that Rome began in 753 BC by Romulus. And in 509, the Republic was formed overnight, and the monarch was replaced by two consuls who had the imperium power. Was the head of the religion, but was the ones who were the commanders in chief. But they had a senate and they had an assembly. So they had more of a republic than of checks and balances, but it was an aristocratic republic. Our argument has been that aristocratic republics last the longest, more than democratic republics, as we saw with Athens and Greece. At the end of the Roman Republic, it ended up with lots of civil wars, lots of violence, lots of lawfare against political opponents. It ended up with a military alliance of rulers under the first triumvirate of Pompey the Great, Julius Caesar, and Crassus that was formed roughly around 60 BC. You remember Julius Caesar had been in Gaul, in present-day France, with his troops in that province, and he decided in 49 BC to cross the Rubicon, the small river. And at that time, never should soldiers from a province enter Italy. And they crossed the Rubicon in 49 BC, and there was no turning back. There was civil war. And in that civil war, Julius Caesar became triumphant. He was a military dictator. By 45 BC, it did not last long. You remember Senators Brutus and Cassius, the most famous conspirators and assassins of all time. They assassinated Julius Caesar on March 15th, 44 BC, in the Senate House. About a year and a half later, Julius Caesar's military lieutenant, Mark Antony, his troops killed Cicero in December of 43 BC. It was a time of violence. Well, through much negotiation, you remember Mark Antony, Octavian, who was the nephew and adopted son of Julius Caesar. He was 18 years old at the time, Octavian. But it was Mark Antony, Octavian, and another military general named Lepidus. They formed the second triumvirate of military leaders to rule Rome. That didn't last long either, and fighting broke out. Octavian became the victor, defeated Mark Antony at the Battle of Actium on the west coast of Greece. It was a naval battle in 31 BC, and he ended up being given the title Augustus by the Roman Senate in 27 BC, but his reign and rule is recognized as the first emperor of Rome from 31 BC when he defeated Mark Antony. And it lasted 45 years to 14 AD. He was the one mentioned at the beginning of Luke 2, that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all should be in the census to be taxed. He was there governing the Roman Empire when our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ was born. He had a lot of reforms trying to bring law and order to the Roman Empire. He always argued that he was restoring the Republic. You remember the Roman Senate also gave him the title Princeps, the first citizen of the Republic. In a sense, he did retain the aristocratic Senate. He purged it of corruption. He reduced its size. He required strict property requirements in the Roman Senate, and as well, moral qualifications for membership. He reduced the size of the army so that it'd be easier to control. He, as the emperor, as Caesar Augustus, was in charge of the provinces that had the army garrisons, and he gave the Senate the provinces to govern that had no army garrisons, so that he maintained control of the army, so that there wouldn't break out a civil war with senators who had the army behind them. If there was active military campaigns, you remember he put his family members in charge of those active military campaigns to also keep things loyal to himself. He was a very wise, shrewd ruler, governing 70 to 100 million people, only 5 million of which were actual citizens. It is amazing how successful he was in his system of government. Even though he was the, in a sense, the emperor, the sole ruler of it all, the Senate did have some power, but the comitia, the assembly, the lower assembly, he essentially took that power over. He didn't have faith in a democracy, any element of democracy. The proletariat, in the classic Roman term, was those men, and there were many of them, that were just shiftless, worthless, lazy, wouldn't work, and all they gave the Roman Empire were children. And they were the classic term of the proletariat. He didn't want them having a vote in the comitia, in the assembly. He did much to bring back patriotism to the Roman Empire. There were lots of building projects. He boasted, you remember, that he found Rome a city of brick and he left it a city of marble. He rebuilt temples, pagan temples. In the middle of his reign in 13 BC, he received the title Pontifex Maximus as the chief high priest of the pagan religion. But he was trying to restore patriotism and love of country with architecture and the arts. He also had Livy, who wrote his History of Rome. Livy died 17 AD. Livy, in his History of Rome, believed that the success of Rome was because of men of character, men of virtue. And that's the way he wrote his History of Rome, glorifying and praising civic virtues, public virtues, and wanting that to be restored. And you remember Virgil and Horace were poets, religious poets. Virgil died 19 BC. Horace died 8 BC. The American founders read Livy's History of Rome, but especially Virgil in his Aeneid, his epic Latin religious poem. And he was trying to restore virtue through his poetry and literature among Roman citizens and subjects. Remember, it was a friend, a wealthy friend of Augustus, that had this literary circle. And that's where there was this personal connection between Caesar Augustus and Virgil. And Virgil believed in labor, pietas, and factum. Labor, the happiness of work. That's where happiness is found. It's a glorious thing to be one who works and is free to work. Believed in pietas, reverent dutifulness. That there's this unique, almost divine calling, is the way he believed, for Romans in the Roman Empire, that for conscience's sake, one ought to do the right thing, and it's glorious for the nation. And fatum is the idea of maintaining the cause of order and justice and freedom, that there was almost a higher calling in his poetry, that this was the call of the Roman Empire, to bring law and order and freedom to the world and to withstand the onslaught of barbarism, to defeat barbarism and chaotic violence in the world. So he did much as well to help restore patriotism at that time, along with the reforms of Caesar Augustus. After Caesar Augustus died, 14 AD, you remember that it was followed by the Julio-Claudian emperors. They ruled the Roman Empire from 14 AD to 68 AD. The last one was Nero. He had local persecution against Christians in Rome, blaming them for the fire that broke out that destroyed most of the districts within the city of Rome. Church tradition believes that both the Apostle Peter and Paul were killed by Nero at that time in the mid-60s AD in Rome. In other words, these Julio-Claudian emperors were not of the virtue of Caesar Augustus. Well, Stoicism was something that came along at that time. It affected some of the leaders. We discussed Stoicism as kind of having these three strands of materialism, pantheism, and order. But it was the porch to Christianity for many, as Russell Kirk says. It was kind of the stepway to Christianity, especially because of the morality, the ethics, and the order that's in it, even though it had materialism and pantheism. But it had started, you remember, in the 3rd century BC in Greece, Stoicism did as a philosophy by several thinkers. But when it was in Rome, at this time, in the 1st century, going into the 2nd century AD, in the Roman Empire, it was mixed with Virgil's labor, pietas, and fatum for virtues. So it was kind of a blend of that virtuous thinking of Virgil with Stoicism. After the Julio-Claudian emperors ended in 68 after Nero's reign, then the Flavian emperors were 69 to 96 AD. And just to say, Vespasian and Titus were the first two there, and those should be of the mind for those who are Christians, saying at 70 AD, the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed. Vespasian was emperor, and Titus was the general. And Titus became emperor for a brief period as well. But that was during that time, in 70 AD. You remember the Colosseum in Rome was built as well during the Flavian emperors from 69 to 96 AD. After them were the adoptive emperors. I want to say something I didn't stress at that time. And we mentioned two, Emperor Trajan among the adoptive emperors. The adoptive emperors, you remember, were from 96 AD to 180 AD, ended with Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic philosopher emperor in 180 AD, these adoptive emperors. But at the beginning of them, their Emperor Trajan was 98 to 117 AD. He is the one who instituted persecution against Christians across the empire. First time across the entire empire, Emperor Trajan. He was followed then by Hadrian, and we brought up Hadrian where he built walls in Britain and parts of Germany, and some of those walls still remain to this day. But I had mentioned that the empire, at that time, the days of Roman expansion came to an end. Now think for a moment. I hadn't read this anywhere, but think. This just hit me like a light bulb this last week. Right after Trajan, as emperor, institutes empire-wide persecution against Christians, the very next emperor, what happens? He builds walls, but the expansion of Rome ends. God rules and reigns over heaven and earth. And it's almost like God said, no more will you expand from here forward in response to persecuting Christians empire-wide. It's fascinating. And persecution, we said, marked the Roman Empire against Christians for 200 years then. After Emperor Trajan, his reign ended 117. You go all the way then to the early 300s, Constantine's conversion as emperor, 312. the Milvian Bridge, and his edict 313 for toleration of Christians. So 200 years was the policy of the Roman Empire to persecute Christians. But right after that, no more expansion. The adoptive emperors, the last one was Marcus Aurelius. We looked at him. He was the Stoic philosopher. As we did mention that he persecuted Christians the most severely of these emperors and the adoptive emperors, even though he was the most, in a sense, moral among the Stoic philosophers, Russell Kirk believes it was through misunderstanding the Christians. One thing to note on him I didn't mention, he's one who martyred at the beginning of his reign, Justin Martyr, arguably, Nick Needham says, the greatest apologist of the Christian church in the second century AD, was martyred by Marcus Aurelius. But Marcus Aurelius wrote his Meditations. Many of the founders of America read his book, Meditations. They were written during his military campaigns in Northwest Europe, fighting the Germanic tribes. Interestingly, Russell Kirk says, in God's providence, his success in his military campaigns against the Germanic tribes set them back for 200 years. That gave Christianity the time to grow and develop within the Roman Empire. So he ended up helping the very people that he persecuted the most, Christians, in God's mysterious providence. Mentioned Captain John Smith in the early colonial plantation in Virginia, of the first Virginians. He enjoyed reading Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, the beginning of the 17th century in the colonial period in America. So that's a quick review. It brings us now up to the end of the political structure that Augustus built. After Marcus Aurelius, many emperors ruled the Roman Empire from 180 to 284 AD. So for the next 100 years, many different emperors ruled the Roman Empire. This whole period of roughly 100 years from 180 to 284 AD can be called a period of military despotism and anarchy. Military despotism and anarchy. There were times during this 100-year period where the Roman Empire almost fell. And it was during those periods of time where Christians were not persecuted as much because there was so much emphasis trying to fight off the Persian Empire in the east or the Germanic tribes in Europe. They didn't have enough energy then and focus to persecute Christians during certain periods because of all the outward threats to the Roman Empire. One of the leading scholars in the 20th century AD, 1900s AD, William McNeill, he says this, quote, between 235 and 285 AD, the Roman world passed through a period of internal anarchy. Provinces were pillaged, towns destroyed, Roman armies fought one another, barbarian invaders ravaged the countryside, and the central power seemed about to disintegrate. Unquote. Not a pretty picture. Clearly, at this time, the structure that Augustus had built is falling apart. And the character of the people, the soul of the people, is in disarray. When the Roman Empire here was near collapse, morally decadent and chaotic, in 284 AD, Diocletian, a soldier, a general, became emperor. And Diocletian, 284 onward, he instituted many reforms trying to save the empire, effectively ending the structure of the empire that Caesar Augustus had built over 250 years earlier. The collapse of the empire's social and political order in the 3rd century AD was primarily caused by three things: political centralization, discord among social classes, and the destruction of small farmers. This social and political disarray and chaos was primarily from three causes: political centralization, discord among social classes, and the destruction of small farmers. So let us discuss each of these one at a time, pondering Emperor Diocletian's reforms. In politics, Rome's failure in the 3rd century AD was quite the opposite of the failure of the Greek polis. You remember when we went through Athens, that the failure of the ancient Greek city-states was tribalism, or you could call it particularism. Many of the Greek city-states were small, with clearly defined stone boundaries for borders, and the ruins of some of those markers still remain in the ground in our day. The Greek city-states were small. Well, the Greek obsession with local concerns is called particularism or tribalism. In other words, what we said, remember, when we went through Athens, is they could never really get along, ever. Their greatest loyalty to was their tribe, their own city-state. Here and there, they formed their leagues, fighting off Persia, you remember. But then, once that was done, they fought each other. With the Peloponnesian War, 27-year war, 431 to 404 B.C., between Sparta and Athens. So in Greece, the problem was particularism, tribalism, localism. Too much loyalty to your local group in Greece. In Rome, the problem's the opposite. The Romans suffered from something very different, what you could call centralization or universalism. In the United States today, we know something of this problem when we say that everything seems to be controlled out of Washington, D.C. Whereas right now, President Trump is trying to close the Federal Department of Education, for example, and roll that power back to the states and to the people. Though Rome did grant certain municipalities within the empire a considerable degree of local autonomy, the great provinces were ruled from the city of Rome. All real power in the empire was concentrated at the center, out of the city of Rome. Russell Kirk, political scientist, a scholar in the 20th century AD, he said this, quote, "The whole imperial structure was grossly over-centralized, and when the center could hold no longer, the bow began to break," unquote. Remember, at this time in human history, there were limited means of communication. You got 100 million people or so spread across a huge geographic area. And you're trying to control it all out of the city of Rome, basically? How does the city of Rome control such a large group of people across such a vast geographic area? Decision-making had to be dispersed back to both the provinces and local communities in some way. The local communities, the provinces, know their own people the best and their own local concerns the best. Nick Needham, church historian, he summarizes Diocletian's administrative dispersal of centralized power away from the city of Rome. This is what he says, quote, "Diocletian divided it into two administrative spheres, east and west, and placed the west under the authority of a colleague, a second emperor, and each emperor was known as an Augustus. Then under each Augustus was a junior emperor called a Caesar. The Augustus ruled some provinces in his half of the empire, and the Caesar ruled the others. When the Augustus died, his Caesar was to take his place. Diocletian also divided up east and west into 12 new administrative districts called dioceses, and changed the structure of the court, civil service, and of the army." William McNeill, he adds that the 12 new districts, the 12 new dioceses in the east and in the west were divided into 12 new districts or dioceses, and each of them were divided into four prefectures, they were called. So there was a lot of administrative division trying to divide it up, break it down, and disperse some local governance. Dividing the empire into two administrative spheres, east and west, made sense because there was an increasing cultural divide between the Greek-speaking east and the Latin-speaking west. And it was self-evident at that time. It made total sense because of the language differences in the Roman Empire at that time to divide it up east and west. And remember, there's that imaginary line between Italy and Greece. So west of Greece, east of Italy, imaginary line north and south. West of there is the west, east of there is the east. And we know from the Bible different languages tend to divide people groups. That's what's expressed for us right at the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11, verses 7 and 8. But all of Diocletian's political reforms were done on the principle, really, that local government governs best. In addition, the military general turned politician Diocletian divided the army into two distinct forces. On the frontiers, the militia, under the command of Duces, D-U-C-E-S, from whence the medieval dukes arise. You know, we talk in the Middle Ages of the dukes. This is where that arose from. Diocletian's reforms. So he's dividing the army up into two branches, one not professionally trained, that's the militia, and the other professionally trained. Okay? Regular troops, which are close to the Augustuses, east and west. But the militia were under the command of the Duces, what would later be called dukes, and they guarded against small-scale raids from barbarian neighbors. But serious campaigning was reserved for mobile and more highly trained forces maintained at strategic centers near each Augustus. You do not maintain power, as we've seen all the way along, unless one person can control the military. Caesar Augustus knew it. After all of the civil wars at the end of the Roman Republic, with the military triumvirates, all you'll end up with is civil wars unless one person can control the military, one commander-in-chief. Well, you end up with one commander-in-chief really in the east and one commander-in-chief in the west. And really, the weakness of it, as we will see later on, is civil war started, right? Between the Augustus of the west, the Augustus of the east, and that's under Constantine and that. You'll end up with civil wars between them, which is what always happens. You need one commander-in-chief. So even his situation, some of his reforms lasted, some didn't. But at America's founding, we tended to have this as well. We had a militia. That was the able-bodied men with the right to keep and bear arms. They were the militia. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state. But we also have a mobile, highly trained military force. Well, that's the way he divided it up. In the end, Russell Kirk says this, in the end, it is certainly a wonder that the political structure endured as long as it did, primarily being governed out of the city of Rome. But it certainly was a 100-year period of military despotism and anarchy. Well, dealing with social conflict, the Romans never succeeded in reconciling the interests of social classes. We saw that early on with Solon in Athens and his reforms, trying to bring harmony among different economic classes. It's a common problem. And at this time, little harmony existed between aristocratic senatorial families and the mass of free citizens, between city populations and rural farmers, or between slave and free. One scholar said this, "Hatred and envy reigned everywhere. The peasants hated the landowners and the officials. The city proletariat hated the city bourgeois. The army was hated by everybody, even by the peasants." Unquote. Now, one of the reasons for the hatred among various classes of people, especially for the Roman army, was how the burdensome tax system worked at this time. From 235 to 285 AD, during that 50-year period, forced extractions of taxes had become common. Some people had to just give up their farms. It got so bad. Early in the 3rd century AD, early in the 200s AD, one of the emperors stated this. He said, quote, "Enrich the soldiers, nothing else matters," unquote. Things were falling apart, and they had to maintain the military. And here, Diocletian's tax reforms amounted to little more than a legalization of the burdensome tax system that had prevailed in the 3rd century AD. Russell Kirk says this, quote, "Grinding taxation impoverished every class, But I did in my reading come across where some of the wealthy were favored for some exemptions that were politically connected, which always tends to be the case. But because the idea was enrich the soldiers, nothing else matters, that's where people begin to have a hatred toward the army. The burdensome taxism ultimately was for the military. Every emperor's existence depended upon a loyal army which must be paid, or else civil wars would arise, and Diocletian's time as emperor was no different. So there was over-centralization, social conflict among all the classes. The third primary cause of all this collapse of the Roman Empire here was the destruction of small farmers. It's interesting, at this time, large agribusinesses flourished. This period of time was marked by the disappearance of a free agricultural population, especially in Italy, Africa, and large portions of Asia, and the growth of tremendous estates tilled by slaves or serfs both transformed the social basis of Roman institutions and resulted in a decline of productivity. When many people went off to fight, they died, someone else took the farm, or the farms were taken over by large estate owners, and serfs or slaves ran them. Russell Kirk notes, attempts to replace private undertakings with state industry did not prosper. It's that idea again that the private sector is always more productive than state-run industry. Economically, during Diocletian's reign, peasants were reduced permanently to serfdom. At this time, wages and prices were fixed. And we know when there are price controls and wage controls, what happens is shortages. Everything was regulated by a central authority. Now you remember when we went through Jerusalem, you remember the wisdom of God for ancient Israel, that plots of land were assigned to various families. And then every Jubilee 50th year, it reverted back to the families. Leviticus chapter 25, verses 8 through 17, and Leviticus 27, verse 24. God always had it in periodic times where a free agricultural population would be maintained in Israel. That land would always go back to the families, that it could never stay in a permanent status of large agribusiness. Moreover, as we noted traveling through Jerusalem, never did ancient Israel ever institute wage and price controls. I have one book in my library, 40 centuries of wage and price controls. Israel's not listed in it, of all the nations that have done it. The wisdom of God in Jerusalem. Your mind tends to go to where we're at today in the United States of America with burdensome regulation, overtaxation. And it is actually pretty hard right now to start and maintain a small business. It's a lot harder than it used to be. President Trump is trying to deregulate right now on small businesses. Through tariffs, he's trying to bring back jobs to America. NAFTA gutted the industrial center of the United States. Well, Diocletian implemented harsh measures in harsh times. There's no doubt about it. In the backdrop of Diocletian's reforms, we've got to remember that the very existence of the Roman Empire almost ended at that time. In addition to over-centralization, conflict among the various social classes, and the destruction of small farmers, he faced military attacks from both the Germanic tribes in Europe and the Persian Empire in the East. To save the state, one scholar put it, Diocletian established a despotism requiring all men to call him Lord and to worship him as a god. Remember, that was more of the Greek way of thinking. So it was more in the East, a tendency to worship the emperor as a god. Russell Kirk's assessment is this, quote, only by doubling or tripling the size of the army. He divided them, yes, into militia on the frontier with taking on the barbarians, having well-trained forces near each Augustus, east and west. but he doubled and tripled the size of the army. Obviously, then, it was a greater tax burden. Russell Kirk says, and by concentrating all that military power in the emperor and his colleagues, and by attempting to give that authority divine sanction, that's how he's trying to hold back the barbarians on the frontier and prevent for a time the internal disintegration of the empire. Unquote. In so doing, Diocletian relentlessly persecuted Christians. They refused to worship him as Kyrios, as Lord. They refused to worship him as a god, so he relentlessly persecuted the Christians. It's interesting, to his selfish advantage, he chose to be the Augustus of the eastern side of the empire, assigning the west to his fellow Augustus. At that time, the east was the better side of the empire to govern. Significantly, the western provinces suffered more severely from civil wars and invasions, and the center of gravity of the empire was moving perceptibly eastward. The Roman Empire fell in the west during the 5th century AD, during the 400s AD, but Diocletian's reforms enabled the empire in the east to survive another 1,000 years. Concerning the high price of Diocletian's reforms, Russell Kirk puts it this way, quote, Diocletian's reorganization of imperial administration, a work continued by his successor Constantine, did save the empire. The West would fall to barbarian invaders in the 5th century, but in the East, that empire, there more Greek and Asiatic than Roman, would survive for 1,000 years longer. Yet this was salvation at the price of servitude. Yet this was salvation at the price of servitude. It is amazing to think that Rome was 1,000 years old when Diocletian rose to power. 753 BC to when he rose to power, the Rome had been around for 1,000 years. Russell Kirk, he asks the question, how was it that Rome, though she gave law to the Gentile world, could not maintain her own civilization? Certainly one reason involves the failings of the order of the Commonwealth. Both Caesar Augustus and Diocletian both reformed the empire in their own unique ways. But above all, by and large, in the people of the Roman society, there were deficiencies of the inner soul. There were deficiencies in the order of their own souls. In other words, Diocletian's administrative reforms could not reform the disorder of men's souls. You remember Plato, died 347 BC, student of Socrates. Plato said that the polis is the human soul writ large. To have a well-ordered society, you have to have people with well-ordered souls. So outward administrative reforms only go so far. At the beginning of the 4th century, in 305 AD to be exact, Diocletian retired to raise cabbages, as he put it. Diocletian retired from being emperor to raise cabbages, as he put it. But 4th century Rome, in short, had become an empire in which many people felt that life was no longer worth living, even to raise cabbages. People were in despair. Many people felt that life was just no longer worth living. You say, why? Russell Kirk notes that the old Roman religion was merely formal and ceremonial. And though the Stoic philosophy did improve the morality of a few of their leaders, it did not work upon the Roman masses effectually. Moreover, the tradition of the West was not to worship its ruler as a god, as was the Greek custom of the East, so Diocletian's emperor worship really never took root, according to Russell Kirk. And then as well, to fill the vacuum of faith at that time, Oriental mystery cults that were Syrian, Egyptian, Greek, and Persian. These Oriental mystery cults flourished in Imperial Rome at this time. What's so important about that? Russell Kirk notes that although the early Roman religion had been more ethical than transcendental, many of the Oriental faiths scarcely were ethical or social at all. It was just about achieving personal nirvana. That these Oriental mystery cults, many involving sexual perversion as well, but they didn't involve really anything ethical necessarily or social. They offered no connection between personal salvation and public order. When certain religions begin to dominate society and those religions have no connection between personal salvation and the public order of society, those religions have no support at all for public order. It was only when Christianity was freed from persecution to enjoy toleration by Emperor Constantine's edict in 313 AD, after his conversion to Christianity a year earlier in 312, it was only then that one's personal salvation and belief in a transcendent truth would be united with the existing public order of society. Something unique with Christianity, that our personal salvation and a belief in a transcendent truth is connected with a public order in society. But sadly, it was too late for this new faith, Christianity, to buttress the whole social fabric of Rome. It was too far gone. Conversions take time. Even when Christianity became the established religion of the empire, late in the 4th century AD, late in the 300s, under Emperor Theodosius the Great, he was emperor 379 to 395 AD, he's the one that made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire in the late 300s, late 4th century AD. But even then, the vast majority of people in the empire were still pagans. Because men could not order their own despairing souls, the order of the commonwealth could not be saved, one scholar puts it. Because men could not order their own despairing souls, the order of the commonwealth could not be saved, unquote. Again, many people felt life was not even worth living. How many people in our society die from drug overdoses every year, commit suicide? The virtue of labor, once espoused by the poet Virgil, was deconsecrated. Labor became tedium, nothing but a burden, not happiness. Russell Kirk states, quote, a servile people labor only under hard necessity or compulsion, unquote. And that's that idea. I had one student once, just a couple years ago in one of my college classes. The student said, I don't know if God exists or not. All I know is that I have to feed my family. She was a single mother with children. This is this idea of the virtue of pietas expressed by Virgil involving reverent dutifulness was lost. Russell Kirk states, quote, most people in the 3rd and 4th centuries lived from day to day as dogs do without thought for anything but immediate physical survival, unquote. Read that again. Russell Kirk states, quote, most people in the 3rd and 4th centuries in the Roman Empire at that time lived from day to day as dogs do, without thought for anything but immediate physical survival, unquote. And that was sadly one of my students' testimony in my class. It's a sad state of affairs when one is only concerned with the immediate state of survival, and that's it. Without the virtue of labor and pietas, the Roman state had become a taskmaster at best. Finally, the virtue of fatum, articulated by the poet Virgil, was also lost. No longer did citizens of the Roman Empire believe that they held an appointed mission to bring order and justice and freedom to the world, holding off violent chaos of the barbarians who were attacking them on all sides. Russell Kirk states this, quote, "Marching into Italy, Alaric and his barbarians, the Visigoths, took the city of Rome, the gates being opened to them by slaves in the night, in the year 410 AD, and sacked the eternal city. After that fall, no one believed in Fatim, for the world had been turned upside down. Now the barbarians were bringing their barbarianism to the world. Many pagans in the Roman Empire blamed the fall of Rome in the West upon Christianity, since it was just within 100 years that Christianity was granted toleration by Constantine and then became the religion of the empire. The majority of people at this time were pagans. And many pagans in the Roman Empire blamed the fall of Rome in the West upon Christianity, since they said the traditional gods and goddesses were mad for having been publicly and officially replaced by Christianity in the empire at the end of the 4th century AD, when Theodosius the Great made Christianity the official religion of the empire. Augustine of Hippo, who died 430 AD, wrote a response to such pagan criticism in a book titled The City of God, to describe how no earthly city in this world could provide eternal peace and security. That it is wrong to think that, even if Rome lasted at that time over 1,000 years. No earthly city will give permanent peace and security. The Christian founders of America also pondered how the majesty that was once Rome had come to such ruin, studying in their day Edward Gibbon, who died 1794, and others who wrote either on the decline and fall of Rome or on the crash of civilizations. So there were more than just Edward Gibbon in his classic work on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. But there were others as well, contemporaries of the founders of America, who were writing about the crash of civilizations and the causes. And the American founders studied them, saying, we want to build the United States of America that will last. We want to build a republic that will last. How can we learn from the decline and fall of the Roman Empire not to repeat their mistakes? Although the order of the polis ultimately depends upon the order of the soul of the citizenry, that does not mean, though, that the political structure of government is meaningless. Accordingly, the history of Rome influenced the governmental structure that was formed in the United States of America. At the U.S. Constitutional Convention in the summer of 1787, when from May to September of 1787, they're meeting at the Constitutional Convention behind closed doors, drafting the U.S. Constitution, a new form of government, our republic. And at that Constitutional Convention, Russell Kirk says, the Roman experience was mentioned repeatedly in the constitutional debates at Philadelphia. Even though they met in secret, James Madison every day wrote notes, and we have his thick volume of his notes from the Constitutional Convention. So we know a lot of what was discussed behind closed doors. But the Roman experience was mentioned repeatedly in the constitutional debates by the American founders at Philadelphia, drafting the U.S. Constitution. Significantly, the particularism that was the problem in ancient Greece, as well as the centralization of the Roman Empire, that was the problem of Rome, were two extremes that the founders sought to avoid and keep in a balance. Not to be too overly centralized, not to be too particularized. By creating a federal form of government with specific enumerated powers, while at the same time allowing state governments to retain general police powers, the founders avoided both extremes, an over-centralized government that destroyed Rome, as well as a mere loose confederation that destroyed Greece. In addition, the founders of America believed Christianity would flourish best with freedom of religion, with the free exercise of religion that was constitutionally protected, at least at the federal level, in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Rome's history certainly provided much for Americans to learn from, both positively and negatively. And there is a cautionary tale for us today in America regarding population replacement through excessive immigration that lacks cultural assimilation. When I was putting together my notes for this, this amazed me when I came across this. I've not read anyone that has applied what happened to Rome on immigration without assimilation and how it helped precipitate the fall of Rome. I'll say it again. There's a great cautionary tale for us today in America regarding population replacement through excessive immigration that lacks cultural assimilation. Cultural assimilation is taking on the culture, the way of thinking, the values, the religion, the virtues of the people you're immigrating into. So you immigrate into the Roman Empire, how do they think? What are their historic old high Roman virtues and values? In America, you immigrate to America, what are American cultural values that made us great? And to assimilate means I take them to be mine now. I think like them now. I'm an American with the American mind. Although 410 AD is usually given as the date in which Rome fell, 476 AD is sometimes taken as marking the final end of the Roman power in the West. Because in 476 AD is when a barbarian soldier, Odoacer, deposed the last Roman emperor of the West and sent the imperial insignia to Constantinople in the East. Significantly, William McNeill states, quote, The German invaders did not deliberately strive to overthrow the Roman Empire. They came to enjoy, not to destroy, the riches and comforts of Roman society, unquote. So when they sacked Rome in 410 AD and they continued in their assault of the Western Empire and finally deposed the last remaining Roman Emperor of the West in 476 and sent the imperial insignia over to Constantinople in the East in 476, William McNeill is saying, when you study them, the German invaders, these barbarians, came really to enjoy, not to destroy, the riches and comforts of Roman society. And I say, is that not basically true today with many immigrants to the Western nations of the world, such as America, where they just come to enjoy the riches and comforts of America, but not to assimilate, not to embrace American values and American ways of thinking. But they come to shop at the local stores and to enjoy all of the riches and comforts of our society. William McNeill states, quote, even before 410 AD, there was the progressive barbarization of the Roman army and government bureaucracy through the admission of Germans and others to the imperial service, unquote. That's William McNeill again. Even before 410 AD, there was the progressive barbarization. Remember, barbarians are those who stutter when they speak. They're not civilized. They're not known for the rule of law. They don't have high virtues. They can kill. They're warriors. But as a society, they're not known for law, order, and freedom. The progressive barbarization of the Roman army and government bureaucracy through the admission of Germans and others to the imperial service occurred before 410 AD. Here's a long quote. I've got to include it by William McNeill. Quote, the practice of allowing barbarians to settle inside the Roman frontiers in return for military service was not new. Even in the time of Augustus, such measures had been resorted to occasionally. But in the 3rd and 4th centuries AD, as depopulation through economic hardship and overtaxation, people were leaving. But in the third and fourth centuries, as depopulation continued to weaken the empire and great tracts of land fell vacant, the number of such grants increased greatly. Grants to allow the barbarians to, well, you come in, we'll let you come in and start settle this land and start farming it after military service. He continues, among the newly settled barbarians, the old classical culture of the high old Roman virtue made little progress. In other words, there was little cultural assimilation to the high old Roman virtue of thinking about labor and pietas and fatum. I'll read it again. Among the newly settled barbarians, the old classical culture made little progress. Yet barbarian volunteers were freely incorporated into the regular Roman army, and many individual Germans were able to rise to high military posts. The emperor makers of the 5th century AD and the 400s AD were almost all such barbarian adventurers. A growing dependence on barbarian soldiers and military leaders obviously augured ill for the indefinite continuance of the Roman state. Unquote. In other words, he is saying as a scholar that you can see the demise of the Roman Empire in the West because of the progressive barbarization of immigrants coming in that would not embrace the high old Roman culture. Today we have depopulation in the West because of widespread abortion and the sexual revolution from the 1960s Cultural Revolution. The U.S. has always been a nation of immigrants, but needs today way more immigrants now to make up for the 60 million babies that have been aborted since 1973, when the U.S. Supreme Court granted women the right to abort their babies. It's estimated 60 million babies have been aborted since 1973 in Roe v. Wade, and we need quite a few million to come in to replace them. Biden is estimated to have allowed in 4 years as president 20 million to just run across the border to enjoy the riches and comforts of America. It has been said that immigration without cultural assimilation is an invasion. It has been said that immigration without cultural assimilation is an invasion. Such a practice contributed to the fall of the Roman Empire, as it surely will do today for the United States. Although allowing immigrants into the United States merely to enjoy our riches and comforts, rather to assimilate and embrace American culture, it well contributed to the destruction of the United States as it did for Rome. It is a lesson we need to learn from the Roman Empire from the 3rd and 4th centuries AD. The similarities to today amaze me. Over-centralization, too much out of Washington, D.C., right? Over-centralization. We've got great social conflict. Some of that's stirred up by the Marxists and communists among us. They survive on class conflict. You destroy the middle class, and you're able to have a massive amount of poor people and a few rich, and you pit them against each other. America's strength, Victor Davis Hanson has noted, America's strength historically has been a strong middle class. What was that at that time in Rome? A free agricultural society of a bunch of small business farmers, middle-class people, making a good living on their own, managing their own farms, and you have a hard time then having one class against another. They're just living life, doing their thing, making a good living, a middle-class living, small-class farmers. But when you destroy that middle class through overtaxation, overregulation, and then you end up with a bunch of proletariat, poor people, and a few rich, and it's easy to be a Marxist communist and pit them against each other. Class warfare takes place. Over-centralization, the destruction of small farmers, and class conflict. But also, as well, immigration without assimilation. The progressive barbarization of Rome took place during the 3rd and 4th centuries, and we have that as well today. That's where you have to develop in America to restore things, decentralization, get things out of D.C., back to the states and to the counties and people. We've got to do what we can to build the middle class back again in America, middle class industry and make it easier to create small businesses and let them flourish, right? Have a strong middle class as well. We've got to have immigration. We're a land of immigrants. We've got to have immigration, yes, but in a way, in an amount that we can assimilate them. We can teach them American values and culture along the way. It takes time. It takes effort, what we're doing right here. All of that is on our plate right now. We're going to end this section here with Rome's legacy of law. Rome's legacy of law. This is extremely important. You remember when we discussed Cicero's writings, Cicero, the leading statesman, lawyer during the time of the fall of the Republic, he said, what is it that is the bond of a civil society, of the polis? What's the true bond? He says, law. Law. When you and I know that we're under the rule of law, all of us are under the law, that we'll be treated equally, no matter who we are. That is our bond, connected in the law. Rome's legacy of law is amazing, and it is still in America today, all the way to you and I today. The American founders, while avoiding the pitfalls of paganism, they were predominantly Christian. While avoiding the pitfalls of paganism, particularism of the ancient Greeks, and over-centralization of Rome, yet they greatly admired the Roman administrative genius, the insights of Cicero and Virgil, the heroic examples of Roman republicans and emperors, and all of that, Russell Kirk says, went into the institutions and the cast of mind of the early Americans who founded this country. But above all, Russell Kirk says, Rome's legacy of law was part of the American inheritance. The 20th century AD American poet Eliot, he wrote that so far as we inherit the civilization of Europe, we remain citizens of the Roman Empire, unquote. Here's a bit longer quote from Russell Kirk, very important. For 1,000 years more, the Empire of the East would maintain its capital at Constantinople, while even in the West, much of what was finest in Roman culture was preserved by the Church, the Catholic Church, in monasteries, if half unconsciously. The body of Roman law endured in the East and centuries later took root again in the West. More than 130 years after Alaric and the Visigoths sacked Rome, the Emperor Justinian published in the East the Corpus Juris Civilis, his elaborate consolidation of Roman law, incorporating the natural law doctrines of such famous Roman jurisconsults as Gaius and Ulpian. That monumental work still is the foundation of modern law in Western Europe and has influenced, if less directly, the laws of England and the United States. Unquote. After the Western Roman Empire fell in the 5th century AD, two forms of Roman law survived in the Middle Ages. After Rome fell in the West in the 5th century AD, two forms of Roman law survived in the Middle Ages. First, there remained a fragmented, vulgar Roman law. A fragmented, vulgar Roman law mixed with Germanic tribal customs in the ruins of what had once been the Roman Empire of Western Europe. Once the Roman Empire fell, Germanic tribes took over Western Europe. Monasteries, Catholic monasteries here and there were preserving Western culture. But in terms of Roman law, it ended up being mixed with Germanic customs. Tribal customs were not laws, technically. They were just customary, what they did in their own tribe. This is the way we do things. There's no legislation that's made, no law publicized, promulgated, written down. It's just we have customs. And Germanic tribal customs of various tribes across Western Europe had Roman law then mixed with them. And that's what's called vulgar Roman law. That continued into the Middle Ages. But there was a second form of Roman law that survived into the Middle Ages, and that is this comprehensive collection of Roman law entitled Corpus Juris Civilis, and that was compiled in about 534 AD. 534 AD by the Eastern Byzantine Emperor Justinian. At his order, Roman law was compiled. Justinian was emperor in the East out of Constantinople from 527 to 565 AD. Around 534 AD was when it was being compiled. By appointing commissions of able jurists to do the work, he salvaged, preserved, and made available, both for his own time and for later centuries, something of the best of Rome's achievement in jurisprudence. The Corpus Juris Civilis is otherwise known as Justinian's Code. Justinian's Code. It had four parts. The principles of law, which had gradually evolved over a long history of the Roman state, and they were reduced to a convenient digest. That was the first part, called digest. The principles of law that had gradually evolved and developed over the long history of the Roman state. That was supplemented by the Institutes, which was a textbook in which legal classifications and first principles of jurisprudence were set down. First principles of legal theory, which Cicero had a lot in his writings. In addition, the decrees of the emperors were compiled in the third part, the Codex, and then the last part, the fourth part, Novellae. Subsequent decrees of the emperors were added. Things that were new were added then in that fourth part. At around the same time Justinian's Code was compiled, in 533-534 AD, Emperor Justinian successfully defeated in Africa the Germanic tribe of the Vandals that had formed a pirate fleet of ships harassing commerce. So in Justinian's reign, he orders this compilation of Roman law involving all its history and fundamental principles of jurisprudence and legal theory. And what he also does is he's trying to restore some of the territory in the West back to the Roman Empire. Okay? The Vandals, the Germanic tribe of the Vandals, had conquered the southern part of the Mediterranean in Africa, the African province. In that same time in which the code is being compiled, he attacks the Vandals, who had formed a pirate fleet of ships harassing commerce in the Mediterranean. But it's where we get the English word vandalism from. Vandalism from these pirates who were committing vandalous acts of piracy. So whenever I come across the term of vandalism in society, someone's putting graffiti on the walls, etc., this is where that came from. Thereafter, the Byzantine rule in Africa lasted until the Arab assault at the end of the 7th century AD. Muhammad, the founder of Islam, died in 632 AD, just to give you a picture of some of the other things taking place at that time. So Muhammad, the founder of Islam, died about 100 years after Justinian's Code was compiled. But then they started spreading. Islam did through military force. The Byzantine Roman Empire survived in the East at Constantinople without a break until 1204 AD. It was not until the conquest of Constantinople by the Ottoman Turks in 1453 AD did self-styled successors of Caesar and Augustus permanently disappear from Constantinople's capital. 1,000 years later. That's where Diocletian's reforms continued for 1,000 years until the Ottoman Turks finally removed any successor to Rome's capital in the East, any successor to Caesar or Augustus. The influence, though, of Justinian's Code, compiled there around 534 AD in the 6th century AD, had a very lasting impact upon Western civilization and eventually for London and America. But it almost did not happen. It almost didn't happen. For over 500 years, Justinian's code in Western Europe was lost. Barbarian tribes governed. They're like, what's the code? Who cares about that? I mean, these are barbarians, right? They're not civilized. You've got a heritage of tremendous legal theory and jurisprudence, and they treated it like dirt. For over 500 years, Justinian's code in Western Europe literally was lost under the chaotic rule of various Germanic tribes. A copy of it was not discovered until about 1080 AD in a library in the free city of Pisa, Italy. It's in northwest Italy. The Leaning Tower of Pisa is there. That famous Leaning Tower of Pisa. That's where it was found 500 years later in a library in this free city. Almost immediately, the newly discovered texts of Roman law were copied and began to be studied in various cities of Italy and elsewhere near the end of the 11th century AD. Now, in God's providence, it was discovered after the great schism in the Catholic Church, East and West, in 1054 AD. In God's providence, Justinian's code was lost until after the official separation East-West, and it's a unique thing because what will develop in the West with canon law lawyers with Justinian's code will give us the first Western legal system in the Middle Ages. Law professors at the newly formed University of Bologna in the northern Italian city of Bologna, more northeast of Pisa, during the 12th and 13th centuries AD, during the 1100s and 1200s AD, taught Roman law from Justinian's code to thousands of students who flocked there from all over Europe. Thousands. In the 1100s and 1200s AD, perhaps even 10,000, I read, flocked there from all over Europe to study Justinian's code. Harold Berman, he wrote a monumental thick book in, I think it was 1982, Law and Revolution. He states this, quote, "They took Justinian's law not primarily as the law applicable in Byzantium in 534 AD. In other words, we're not studying it just as a piece of history to say, well, that's the law back then in 534, 500 years earlier. But they took it as the law applicable at all times and in all places. As the law applicable at all times and in all places," unquote. I ask why. Because of the way law and legal theory developed in the Roman Republic and the Empire that we have covered. You remember the jus civile, the civil law, and the jus gentium, the law of nations, and the recognition of the jus naturale, the natural law. That as the Roman Republic spread across Italy, more and more different groups were brought in, but not all were granted citizenship. And they had alliances. But they were under the control of the Roman Republic. And when differences occurred, when conflict, legal conflict occurred, the judges that were over them had to find underlying justice principles, principles of justice and fairness to deal and say, what is it that is the underlying similarity between these different paradox of laws, but yet something underlying is the same. And that's where they ended up developing and finding and discovering natural law principles, eternal principles of natural law of right and wrong from studying the various laws of different groups. And you remember in Cicero's writings how he very clearly laid out the principles of natural law from a supreme God in his providence, because human beings are between the animals and God, And human beings have a distinct nature that does not change. And we share with the supreme divine God reason and justice. And there is right and wrong tied to who we are, tied to nature. And remember Cicero's words that only fools think that they can vote against nature. This is what they were studying. This is what was a part of Justinian's code, the jurisprudence principles of not just particular laws, but of legal theory, of natural law. And therefore, when you're studying, saying these are laws that are applicable at all times and in all places, because God, the supreme God, and they're studying as Christians, that Yahweh, who created all things, is the providential God who created us in His image, and we share with Him reason and justice. And right and wrong is tied to who we are and the nature of things, objectively outside of us, that are eternal principles of right and wrong, that are right and wrong whether in 534 AD or in 1080 AD or in our day today or in 1776. So far, pondering America and Western civilization, we have traveled through Jerusalem, ancient Israel, Athens, ancient Greece, and we are now nearing the end of our journey through Rome, the ancient Roman Republic and the Roman Empire in the West. Harold Berman, the one who wrote that monumental piece, Law and Revolution, observes this, quote, Israel, what we've called Jerusalem, Greece, called Athens, and Rome became spiritual ancestors of the West, not primarily by a process of survival or succession, but primarily by a process of adoption. The West adopted them as ancestors. Moreover, it adopted them selectively, different parts at different times. Unquote. Did our founders or us adopt wholesale the entire book of the covenant of the law to Jerusalem? No. We're not ancient Israel. We're a Gentile nation. We're not as a nation in a covenant with God. Did we adopt in wholesale the instructions on holiness to Jerusalem? No, we didn't. We believe the ceremonial law was fulfilled in Christ. So we adopt it selectively, how we ought to adopt it according to the instruction of Scripture. You see? Different parts at different times. Such that we can say that the legal system of the West in the late 11th and early 12th centuries combined all three and thereby transformed each one to fit their unique circumstances in the Middle Ages. They're thinking through this all as scholastic theologians, the canon law lawyers of the church, systematically and logically, what fits and doesn't fit with principles of law and justice. And they're pondering Jerusalem, they're pondering Greece, and they're pondering Rome, particularly after the rediscovery of Justinian's code. But so far, these three threads, you see, are brought together. They're interwoven into a legal system that the canon law lawyers of the Catholic Church of the Middle Ages interwove together. All three strands. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 12 says that a threefold cord is not easily broken. And that threefold cord will influence the legal system of both London and America. And really, when you get to America, it'll be a fourfold cord. Because what we did is adopted selective parts of English common law, but not all of it. Because we're a republic, not a monarchy. But it will be a fourfold cord when we get to the America's founding of Jerusalem, Athens, Rome, and London. I'm always troubled when I read anything on Western civilization and there's not much on law. The central thing of our civilization and society is law. It was in Jerusalem, but it was through the ages. And we will ponder more of that legal history in the Middle Ages later on. But for now, hopefully you understand a bit more of how not just Rome, but Roman law has influenced Western civilization. Lord willing, the next time we meet, we're going to look at the brilliance of Christianity. The brilliance of Christianity for civilization and society. Christianity is the bridge, in a sense, after the fall of the Roman Empire in the West. It's Christianity that's the bridge then to London and then to America. So, Lord willing, that's where we'll pick it up.